Libby may well have been threatening him. I don't like dwelling on what it might be, but Libby says she can prove she and Carr knew each other in the biblical sense. Somebody needs to get a warrant to search Libby's condo for a little blue bag or suitcase where she's got the evidence stashed away. I agree that an affair doesn't warrant murder. If there was more than one indiscretion on Carr's part, and with Donnelly, too, that might make the licensure board's sanctions more serious. But a reason to kill Libby? I'm dubious. I've seen dumber reasons to kill somebody, I guess, the detective commented. You might try talking to that skanky lawyer of hers. He'll hide behind lawyer-client privilege, but it's possible Libby was threatening to take Carr to court, perhaps sue him for damages because of his breach of professionalism. That's pure speculation, but it could have caused more of a stink than filing a complaint against him with some board. Heck, Carr's malpractice insurance fees might even have gone up if they had to defend him in court. Still, it's hard to believe that would drive him to commit murder. And why would Carr want to kill me? Could be you were in the wrong place at the wrong time, courtesy of the kismet you love so much. I knew you'd get around to the curse of kismet somehow. What if Libby and Shannon were on to Carr's scheming and planning to out him? What kind of scheme? Extortion, wrapped in a layer of psychobabble about abuse? I'll remind you that this is off the record, and I won't go into all the disgusting details. With her psychiatrist's backing, Libby went after family members with allegations of childhood sexual abuse. Then she tried to shake down her parents for hush money. At the top of the tram, Libby admitted the allegations were false and claimed the good doctor came up with the idea to demand money. Murder makes more sense if he was trying to avoid criminal charges. It does, Detective Hernandez said. Worse for Carr if he was behind Shannon's disappearance. Too bad Libby wasn't more direct. She took responsibility, claiming Shannon's gone because she told Carr her friend planned to squeal on him. Tell what to whom? I don't know. More important now is that Libby said she told them about Shannon's plans. A conspiracy sounded like paranoia until that incident in the ICU. It might have been more believable, too, if Libby hadn't raved about a red devil being behind it all. Ay. Dios mio, Bernadette gasped, making the sign of the cross as Jessica uttered those words. That sounds out there, all right. A blue suitcase and a red devil. Okay.
He was shaking his head.
But there must be more going on, Detective. The head shrinker is dead, so who is trying to make sure Libby gets to meet up with him so soon? It must be important, too, to be stampeding the hospital como un elefante en una cristalería. Bernadette said, making stomping motions with her feet.
Libby's given us plenty of reasons not to believe a word she says, but Bernadette's asking the right question, Jessica said. Bernadette nodded in solemn agreement.
More than you know, the detective said.
He was leaning forward, staring into the cup of coffee he held in both hands.
It turns out the guy who came after Libby was a pro. The Palm Springs PD identified him right away after that crash and burn incident on Raymond Road. Don't ask me how, but they got prints off the guy. He popped up in the system with half a dozen aliases and wanted for questioning in a homicide-for-hire case. With a resume like his, it's reasonable to assume someone paid him to take out Libby Vanderwert. She must know something someone doesn't want her to share. It's got to be more than the contents of that little blue suitcase, because the guy she could hurt with that evidence is dead. So yes, who wants Libby dead is the right question, Bernadette.
Right question, but not a good one, is it? Bernadette asked with apprehension.
No, not a good one at all. There's more. The accident that took out Libby's would-be assassin wasn't an accident at all. They've gone over the footage from the car chase, and there's a flash as someone took a shot at the speeding car. Some shot, too. It hit a tire that triggered the wreck.
No, Jessica and Bernadette cried out in tandem.
Yes, it's clear Libby's in way over her head. Whatever was going on with Carr and Donnelly and an unknown co-conspirator, more likely human than devil, does not get the woman off the hook. If even part of what you're saying turns out to be true, it points to a motive for Libby to be a murderer. In her twisted mind,
She had plenty of reasons to kill Donnelly and Carr if the doctor was fooling around with her friend. I'll go back to Donnelly's poor parents and ask if their precious daughter was extorting them. Who wants Libby dead is another matter. Whatever the motive, you're right, too, that he's in a hurry to get the job done. He's got money to hire a pro, too. Could be, if he was Carr's partner in that extortion racket. It has paid well. Anyway, it's time to sit back and count your blessings, Jessica. You're still alive. That could be more miraculous than we know, depending on what Libby's mixed up in. Oh, what a tangled web we weave, he said, as he sauntered out the door, a plate of bizcochitos and the recipe in hand. He's right about a tangled web, Jessica said, dragging herself off the couch. It was time to shower and dress for her doctor's appointment. Maybe for Libby, but it's not like you were her lawyer. I don't see why anyone would have it in for you. Except that my name is splashed all over the media right along with hers. Carr blamed me for some change of heart on Libby's part. Maybe his colleagues do, too. Or maybe Carr thought Libby told me too much about whatever the hell is going on, including Shannon's murder. Jessica had wandered down the hallway to her bedroom, with Bernadette at her heels. Un momento, Bernadette ordered, taking charge. She pulled out a small pair of scissors from a pocket, clipped the tape, and removed the bandage on Jessica's right hand.
Mira, chica. Mejor. ¿Sí?
Sí. Mucho mejor, Jessica agreed. Her palm was much better. The slash, closed with surgical glue, was a tidy line, darker than the original lifeline on her palm it crossed, a reminder of how close she had come to ending her life altogether. Ir, Bernadette said, shoving a plastic bag into Jessica's hand for her cast. Then, Jessica slipped out of the sling with Bernadette's help.
You'll feel better after you shower.
Call her if you get stuck, she said, as she dashed from the room. I'm just going to climb back into bed and forget about all of this, Jessica said, taking a step toward her unmade bed. The soft sheets and silky duvet called to her.
Oh, no, you don't,
Bernadette hollered from down the hall.
Get crackling.
Cracking, Bernadette. Get cracking, she hollered to her.
That's what I said. Call Peter and get a shower. I'm fixing us a salad.
Full of bizcochitos, Jessica didn't see how she could eat a salad, but Bernadette was too far away to hear her objections, and she wouldn't have listened anyway. Jessica pulled out her cell phone and confirmed that she had an escort for the short jaunt to the medical center. It was reassuring to talk to Peter. He and his crew had skills, too. If anyone could keep a sniper from shooting out the tires on the huge Escalade that the petite Bernadette would drive, it would be Peter and his team. The shower was wonderful, except the part where she had to raise an arm over her head to shampoo her hair. Her ribs objected, so she did the minimum to mix the shampoo through her hair. Bending over to scrub her legs and feet was out, too. She just stood there, letting the water blast away from all 8 sprayers set on gentle, aiming at her from different points in the enormous shower. It cleared her head. While she was at the medical center, she would pay a visit to the ICU. Maybe Libby was coming around and had more to say that might help make sense of this mess. At least she could find out when, and if, Libby would ever have more to say about anything. 17. Thor and Uber Thor. Jessica's trip to the medical center brought good news and bad news. A quick x-ray revealed her broken arm was on the mend. The swelling around her shoulder joint was almost gone, and the bruising around her ribs was better, too. She left with a new sling, a small band-aid on the injured right hand, and a prescription for more pain pills. As long as I'm careful, Dr. Ziegler, I can get through the day with aspirin and use the pain pills to sleep at night. That's great. You're young and a fast healer. But there's no reason to play the martyr. If you need the pills, use them.
I hear you, was what she said. No way in hell, was what she thought. That set off a flurry of worry about her mother. How was she doing in that Malibu treatment facility? Could they help her? How uncomfortable was she in detox, given the mix of drugs and alcohol she'd given up? It would be another day before Jessica could call or visit.
Good news from her doctor meant a road trip was in her future. Saturday or Sunday, she was Malibu bound. The first bout of bad news came even before Jessica could report the good news about her checkup to Bernadette. When Jessica returned to the waiting room where Bernadette sat, a woman approached.
"Hey, aren't you the one who fell off Mount San Jacinto?
Earl, get over here, quick," she said to an older man sitting in the corner, staring at the television. He didn't look like he was going anywhere.
"Earl, it's her, I told you. It's the Angel Heiress. Can I get your autograph? Hang on a minute. Let me get a pen and paper."
Jessica didn't know what to say. Two women sitting in another corner of the waiting room whispered to each other.
"Can you give me a hand here, Earl? I need a pin."
Earl took his eyes off the TV for a second and clapped a few times.
"That's not funny, Earl."
Then, with a burst of speed, she took off and knocked on the nurse's window.
"Can I borrow a pen, please? It's the Angel Heiress. I want her to sign something for me. Thanks."
She grabbed the pen and dashed back over to where Jessica had stepped closer to the exit, motioning for Bernadette to follow. Bernadette stood up, but couldn't hide her amusement at Jessica's plight.
"It is you, isn't it?" the woman asked.
How on earth did you respond to a question like that? Jessica wondered, as she decided the simplest thing was to keep mum and oblige the request. Jessica accepted the pen the woman offered her. Writing would be no problem now without the cumbersome bandage on her hand. What the heck was she supposed to do? Sign it? Like it was a receipt? Jessica must have looked as flummoxed as she felt.
"Just say, to Ellie with blessings, E-L-L-I-E, and sign your name. Your full name," she said. "Oh, and add Angel Heiress, okay?"
Jessica did as she asked. Ellie ripped the top page from the notepad.
"This one is for Earl," Ellie said. "That's E-A-R-L.
While Jessica scrawled, "To Earl with blessings, Jessica Huntington," on a new sheet of paper, Ellie perused Jessica's handiwork on the first. Writing with that pen had been harder than Jessica expected.
"You're not good at this, are you?" she asked. "You sure you're you?"
"Oh, I'm me," Jessica responded. Who else could get into a situation like this in the playground of presidents, moguls, and movie stars? At the moment, the Coachella Valley, known for being rather nonchalant about celebrities, was not living up to its reputation. Bernadette looked at the floor. Jessica hoped she was looking for a place where the carpet was loose enough that Jessica could crawl under it. That wasn't likely, since Bernadette was laughing.
"Well, I could get more on eBay for it if it was neater. Oh, well, let me see the one for Earl."
Ellie clucked as she looked at Jessica's second attempt. She pushed it back toward Jessica and shook her head in disdain.
"You forgot Angel Heiress. That's the best part."
"Just put it right in there," she said, pointing to the spot where she wanted it. Earl had stirred. The guy had to be in his 80s and was making his way to Ellie's side using his walker. The two whispering women in the corner rose to their feet. One held a magazine she'd picked up off the table near her seat. The other was digging through her purse and came out with a notepad of her own. They headed Jessica's way, pens at the ready. A flash went off. Another patient in waiting must have decided a photo would be a better memento of the occasion than an autograph. Several others, still seated in the crowded room, whipped out smartphones and took photos or video.
"Are you really an heiress?" someone asked from behind Jessica.
She jumped out of her skin. Her ribs made her pay. Her heart raced as the person behind her reached out and rubbed her cast as if it was a genie's lamp. A line had formed. No, it was more a ring than a line, and they were closing in on her, walkers and all. They don't call Palm Springs God's waiting room for nothing, she thought, as a horde of octogenarians descended upon her. An orthopedics waiting room in the Palm Springs area was a foyer to the pearly gates. Jessica glanced again at Bernadette. Her eyes were still downcast, and her shoulders shimmied with laughter. Jessica tried to sign the things being shoved her way. There had to be a dozen people around her now, and another half dozen ambling her way.
She saved that other girl. She's an heiress, all right. And an angel,
someone else said, reaching out. This one did a little knock-knock on Jessica's cast.
That's for luck,
the smiling cast knocker said. It's a miracle she's alive, the cast knocker asserted. You're lucky you're not dead, aren't you? Jessica had no time to reply.
You're right. She has to be an angel,
another member of the crowd added, as she moved a step closer to Jessica. The entire crowd was closing in around her, the circle growing smaller.
If she's an angel, she's an awfully foxy one. Sign this, baby,
a young man said, as he approached her with his shirt raised and his abs exposed. Not bad, but no way was she going to sign his exposed six-pack.
Bernadette, we have an appointment elsewhere, do we not? Jessica asked.
Do we not? Will you listen to that? That's rich woman talk if I ever heard it, someone hooted.
That proves the heiress part, another said. That's the money talking.
Cordelia Watson, a nurse announced, calling the next person to the back for her appointment. What is going on out here? The nurse asked as she stepped into the fray. Answers came in a jumble as the level of noise increased. Jessica used the momentary distraction by the nurse to slip through an opening and step toward the door. That drew fire from the crowd.
Hey, she's trying to leave without giving us her autograph, one member complained.
She has an appointment elsewhere, another mocked. Bernadette had stopped laughing.
And is there a problem with that?
The crowd went silent as that question boomed above the hubbub. Peter stood in the doorway, hands on his hips, like the Jolly Green Giant, only not green and not jolly. That flash went off again, along with the clicks of smartphones snapping photos.
Are you ready to go, Miss Huntington? We're running behind schedule,
he said, glaring at the crowd as he stepped aside so she could pass.
It's Thor and Uber Thor,
someone in the crowd snickered. Right behind Peter was Brian, his shock of surfer boy blonde hair a striking contrast to the black T-shirt he wore, plastered over bulging muscles. He and Peter were quite the pair in their look-alike security company clothing.
Shut up, you idiot. Either one of them could snap your scrawny neck like a toothpick.
Murmurs of bodyguards passed through the crowd as they all left.
Ready to get out of here?
Peter inquired as they headed down the hall leading away from the waiting room crowd. She could hear the cry of the nurse trying to restore order.
Hope this doesn't get back to Nurse Andrews, Jessica sniffed with indignation.
I am so ready, Peter, but I'd like to stop by the ICU, just for a moment. Is there a quick way to get there from here?
Follow me. Put your sunglasses on. Maybe that'll keep people from recognizing you. No more of that fan club stuff today,
Bernadette said, as she made a right turn toward a bank of elevators. More like angry villagers who've got the monster cornered. Smartphones instead of torches, Jessica sputtered as she put on a pair of sunglasses she found in a pocket of her purse. I have to give Cassie credit for putting up with that all the time.
Here, use this, too,
Peter added, handing her his baseball cap to put on. How did you know I was in trouble? Peter held up fingers, one at a time.
One, the body count of dead and wounded has climbed. Two, you've added bandages to your attire. And three, there were bad guys running around with guns, and we're back at the scene of a crime. I wouldn't leave you alone for long.
He did that smiling thing that never worked for him. The grin faded, and grim-faced Peter returned. Jessica relaxed.
After what went on in this hospital, I never should have let you two come up here alone. At least, not without checking it out first. If Brian hadn't been running his mouth, that might have dawned on me sooner.
What do you mean?
Brian asked as they sped off after Bernadette, who was on the move.
What I mean is that it's been dude this and dude that since you got in the car this morning. That's in between the pleas for food every hour on the hour like a baby. At least when you're shoving food in your mouth, I get a few minutes of quiet. Except for the slurping and the smacking, that is. Something happens to my brain. To tune you out, I've got to shut down critical faculties. Not good.
Tune me out? Why?
Brian did a little quick step to keep up with Peter's longer stride. It was like watching a Chester and Spike cartoon, with Brian, the little dog, moving from one side to the other of the big dog, Peter. Jessica expected big dog to reach out and smack little dog any second. Brian was going on and on about how he was doing everything Peter asked, and he couldn't help it if he got hungry, and they had to go get coffee anyway. "You drink a lot of coffee, even for a humongous guy, dude," he said. "Not that much, dude. Anyway, I've got to have a lot of caffeine to keep up with your mouth." The ping of the elevator stopped the conversation for a moment as they all filed in. "That's bogus. I feel all this pressure, man, to keep up the conversation. You go all dodgy on me, like, 'Ooh, I'm a secret agent. I know plenty, but I'm not talking,' or something like that."
"Yeah. So what's your point?"
"How am I going to learn all that secret stuff if you don't teach me?"
"You're in training to do security, not spy work."
"What's the difference if you don't teach me any of it anyway?"
"Lesson one, look and listen," Peter said, pointing two fingers at his eyes, then at Brian, and then tugging at his ear. "Lesson two, zip it," he said, making a zipping motion across his lips.
Jessica coughed a time or two to stifle her laughter. That hurt, but laughing at the interaction between the two men would have hurt more than the little fake cough. She wasn't sure she should encourage the sniping anyway.
"Bastante. Is this what you two do in the car all day? You seem to have plenty to say, Peter. Just what are you trying to teach Brian? How to talk the bad guys into giving themselves up? Take them on one of those ride-alongs, and I bet they'll confess to anything in no time."
"Ay, ay, ay," Bernadette said, staring up at the two men and shaking her head. Brian and Peter stopped speaking at her command. They both looked at her with the same quizzical expressions on their faces.
"What do you mean?" Thor and Uber Thor asked, almost in unison.
That was it. Jessica lost it and burst out laughing.
"Oh, ow, ow! Stop it, all of you, before I've got to check myself back in here. The nursing staff won't like that one bit. Please, I can't breathe and it hurts. Oh, stop. Please."
Jessica fought to get her breath back, even though all three of her companions were now looking at her like she was the one being ridiculous. She had to hustle once they got off that elevator. Bernadette flew down the hallway, made a couple quick turns down more hallways, and they were in the ICU.
"Wow, Bernadette, you sure do know your way around," Jessica observed as she caught up, out of breath.
"Hey, I made a few coffee runs that first night we were here, waiting to find out if you would be okay. I figured out the quickest way back and forth to the cafeteria and coffee bar."
"Cafeteria?" Brian asked, on high alert. "Coffee bar?" Peter asked, with almost as much eagerness in his voice.
Jessica tried to shush them all as she approached the nurse's station. They were getting scrutiny from a nurse on duty. A police officer, still posted close to what must be Libby's room, stood and walked toward them.
"Can I help you?" the nurse asked.
"Yes, I'd like to see Libby Vanderwert. Is she permitted visitors?" Jessica inquired.
"You can't all be family."
"No, we're, well...
Jessica?
Is that you?"
a soft voice asked from behind them. When Jessica turned, Nora Vanderwert rushed forward to greet them. She had just stepped out of one of the rooms they'd passed. The woman had been crying.
"Nora, what's happened?"
"Libby's taken a turn for the worse. We don't know what's going on. The doctors are with her now. I'm doing what I do best in situations like this.
Sit and wait."
"What are you doing here?"
"I hoped to look in on Libby while I was here for a checkup. Do you want me to sit with you while you wait? Bernadette and my friends were just talking about going for coffee. Can they bring you some?"
"That would be great. If you don't mind, I'd appreciate it. I don't think we've met," she said, holding out her hand and introducing herself to Peter and Brian.
Peter did a quick check of the area. The nurse gave him dirty looks and was about to chide him, but the police officer gave her a reassuring nod as he and Peter had a chat. Jessica followed Nora into the waiting area.
"It looks okay, Jessica. None of your autograph seekers will get past that nurse or the police officer.
We'll give you two a few minutes of privacy, but stay put, okay?
Sure. Thanks.
The two men hurried off after Bernadette, who was already increasing the distance between them.
Let's have a seat and you can tell me what's happened.
Nora sank into a nearby chair. Jessica followed, easing her way into a seat next to her.
I'm not sure what happened or what it means. I came down here to visit, and I was in there for a few minutes when she stirred. Then she opened her eyes.
She looked as though she was still trying to process the moment that followed.
I felt stunned after that when she spoke. I was so excited, I couldn't breathe. Do you know what my daughter's first words were?
No, Jessica replied, feeling her body stiffen in anticipation.
Libby opened her eyes and said, "Where is that bastard? He's going to pay," or something to that effect. It was such a relief to see her awake, but then she uttered those words in this awful, vicious tone.
What did you do?
I wasn't sure if I should keep her talking or urge her to be quiet, so I hit the call button for the nurse. Then I said, "Libby, it's okay. It's Mom."
She closed her eyes again, but opened them when I called her by name. She stared at me with cold, hard eyes.
"Where is that son of a bitch car, Mom?"
I didn't want to tell her he's dead. All I said was, "It's okay, Libby. He's not here. You're safe."
The nurse came into the room right then and checked all the readings on the equipment. Libby was getting more and more upset, even trying to sit up.
"Tell Jessica to get him. All she needs is in that blue case at my house. She has to get the rosary, too. And something about a key, or it's a key." She was growling in between curses and spitting like a rabid dog. Then she just seized up, spewed foam, and her body convulsed. The nurse sent out a code, and a team rushed in to work on her. They shoved me out of there when they wheeled in the cart with the resuscitation equipment on it. That was over an hour ago. She's stable again, but nobody can tell me what happened or why, much less what any of it means for her recovery. I went back in there for a moment, but I can't tell anything by looking at her. The doctors are checking on her now.
I am so sorry.
It's the story of my life with Libby. I feel exhilaration one minute, terror and disappointment the next, followed by confusion that never goes away. I thought you should know she had a message for you.
I don't get that either.
Does it have something to do with why she called you to meet at the top of the tram? Have you got any idea what that was all about?
I know Paul already told you about the admission she made to me that the allegations toward Nick and his brother were false, and that Carr put her up to trying to get money from you and Nick. I don't quite know what else is going on, but I am trying to piece it together.
That day at my office, she got it right away that the good doctor and I didn't hit it off. I thought that amused her. In fact, later, I wondered if she'd engineered it that way.
That would be like her.
It bothered me enough to have our investigators at the firm inspect the guy again. We had done the background check on him you asked us to do. Carr had come up clean, although he's bounced around from place to place. Lots of his affiliations didn't last long. That's a little odd, given most places need a psychiatrist of record on their team, and there's a shortage. What we encountered when we dug deeper the second time around were several "can't talk about it" or "no comment" responses. Open hostility, even, at the mention of his name. That tells me he did not leave on good terms, and there may have been a confidentiality clause resulting from legal proceedings. We haven't found any public records about legal problems, so whatever went on must have happened outside of a courtroom. At least part of the problem, according to what Libby told me up on Mount San Jacinto, could be that Carr didn't always keep his interest in his clients strictly professional.
That doesn't surprise me. I was almost certain that's what Libby was trying to tell me months ago when she was gushing about him like he was a rock star.
If he made a habit of crossing the line, it would explain his sudden departures under unpleasant circumstances. Even though it's behavior that ought to be reported, agencies don't want bad news to get out, so they handle it themselves. Often guys like Carr move on, continue to practice, and do it again elsewhere.
That's part of what she was trying to say today, about making him pay. Could be about feeling betrayed, or because he was hell-bent on getting rid of her. I'm still trying to figure out why. A wave of sadness hit Jessica. I'm so sorry I couldn't have done more before this all got out of hand. When Libby tried to contact me after that unexpected meeting in my office, I told her to go through her attorney. Maybe she'll pull through. Good Lord, she almost killed you, and you're sorry. You had to behave in a professional way with Libby, or you'd have an ethics mess on your hands, too. Besides that, she's still alive, thanks to you, from what I've heard. This isn't the first time I've had to face the prospect of losing Libby. I've mourned her loss for a long time. I have memories of her, like any mother does. Cherished ones. Mine to keep. Libby as the infant I cuddled, and as the toddler I taught to walk and talk. Images of sweet little Libby at Christmases, birthday parties, trick-or-treating, and her first day of school are all stored away in my mind and heart. I tried to keep that girl alive as long as I could, even as she slipped away. When she came after her father and her uncle, I knew that girl was gone, nor would she ever be the woman I hoped she might become. Tears fell as Nora whispered those last few words. I can't imagine what that must feel like. I'm sorry. Jessica wished she could offer something more tangible in the way of support. It is what it is, as they say. I don't have to like it. I just need to face it. Lord knows I'm not alone. Parents of seriously mentally ill children have to come to grips with what they can expect of their children as adults. Mental illness is as devastating as any physical illness. Maybe more so, because it's so hard to know what's a sickness and what's not. You'd think I'd be better at figuring it out, having grown up with a mother who was disturbed. But I don't get it. That she's stable again is a good sign. Could be. But nothing will ever be the way it was before this latest mess. Even if she recovers, I won't trust her, or have the same hope for her ever again. You don't know that. Where there's life, there's hope. That sounds trite, but it's true. Jessica caught an image of her mother, leaving the house with Hank at her side. Would things ever be the same for her relationship with her mother? Change might be good. Nora must have read Jessica's thoughts. Maybe it's a good thing not to go back to the way things were. I'll place my hope in that. It's all over for Carr, now at least. Are you still investigating him? Yes. What's happened to Shannon Donnelly is still up in the air, and he may have had something to do with that. According to Libby, Shannon was having a fling with Carr, too, so he may turn out to be the linchpin in all this, dead or not. What about that little blue suitcase, or a bag she mentioned? Do you know what that is, or where? No, I've never seen a blue suitcase. It might be at her condo. Her car is in a parking garage there, too. You're welcome to take a look around yourself, or send Jerry. Keys to her condo and car are on my keyring if you want them. Sure. That would be great, if you don't mind. Mind? No. If Libby survives, and her psyche is at all intact, if that's something you can ever say about Libby, she'll be facing a lot of questions. It will help her if you can figure out what's going on. I have been so out of it, I haven't even had time to process what it means that someone tried to kill her here, in the ICU. The police asked me about it. How do I know who my daughter's enemies might be? I didn't even know Nick and I were on that list until recently. Sometimes I still wonder where I went wrong as a mom. It's so hard not to blame yourself. Everyone else still blames moms when their kids go wrong. Nora handed keys to Jessica. One, an electronic key that belonged to the car, another for the door to the condo, and a smaller key. That little key is for a mailbox. That someone is still after Libby is the scariest part of this. The police are making progress. I'm sure they'll share what they've learned with you if you call Palm Springs PD. In the meantime, I'll get someone to look for that bag. Does what she had to say about a rosary mean anything to you? Is she a Catholic? We raised her as a Catholic. dragged her kicking and screaming through all the CCD classes. She took me to task more than once for putting her through it, loading her up with guilt, blah, blah, blah. If she goes to Mass or owns a rosary, it would surprise me, so I have no clue what she's talking about or what that has to do with the key. Could be none of it means a thing. With Libby, you never know. They sat in silence for several more minutes before Jessica's trio of friends returned with coffee. Peter passed a large cup to Nora. Jessica was ready for a cup, too, after that sad conversation. Blessed Bernadette had brought her one, even though she hadn't asked for it. Peter was guzzling coffee, and Brian was stuffing his face, so no more banter. She was about to say goodbye when the doctors came into the waiting room and told Nora she could go back to Libby's bedside. They had little to report about what had happened to Libby, or her prognosis. On the ride home, Jessica was quiet. Nora had spoken from the heart when she said daughters don't always become the women their parents hope they will become. Mothers aren't always what you hope for either. She was deep in thought when Bernadette spoke.
Mira, Jessica, something's going on.
What does that mean? Jessica asked as her heart leapt into her throat. A huge dark-colored SUV pulled in behind them, in between their Escalade and the SUV that Peter and Brian occupied.
You want me to step on it? This car is big, but it can move when I want it to.
Jessica looked around at the afternoon traffic. It wasn't bad yet, but there wasn't much room in which to maneuver.
Where are you going to go? Back to Mission Hills, fast, and get us behind the guard gate,
she responded, speeding up as she spoke.
You're going fast enough already to do that.
It hurt to turn around, but Jessica managed and saw that the SUV was staying right with them, not far from their bumper, as Bernadette sped up.
Okay, so maybe you've got the right idea. Step on it.
As she spoke those words, a second dark-colored SUV moved in beside them. The tinted windows were so dark that she couldn't see who was driving. She and Bernadette were in the far left lane and had passed the last possible turnaround. There wasn't anywhere for them to go now except forward. At least no one was taking potshots at them.
Jeez, Jessica muttered. We're sitting ducks.
Not quite. I've got us covered.
Bernadette reached into a pocket between the driver's seat and the door and pulled out a gun. She set it on her lap so she could return to driving with both hands.
Oh, my God! Bernadette, what are you doing with Dad's gun?
Take it, Jessica. Don't use it unless you have to. I got to concentrate on driving. That light up ahead is about to change. I can beat it.
Jessica reached over and took the gun. Twisting got her a round of protests from her ribs. No matter. Her heart was pounding against her ribcage so hard that she couldn't catch her breath anyway. Another jolt ran through her when her phone rang. She whisked it out of her purse and answered.
Hello?
Jessica. It's Peter. We've got a situation on our hands. A bogey on your tail, about three cars back.
Three cars back? What are you talking about? There's one almost in our back seat, and another in the lane next to us.
In that instant, a third SUV appeared out of nowhere. This one swerved across two lanes of traffic to get in front of them. Cars honked as it cut them off. That third car hemmed them in. Bernadette honked and sped up, getting as close as she could to the bumper of the SUV in front of her.
We're surrounded. Do you think these are kidnappers? Should I run the light if I can get around the guy in front of us?
Run the light? What are you talking about? Jessica asked.
I didn't say anything about running the light, Peter said.
Not you. Bernadette's lost her mind. She's talking crazy.
The Mission Hills gate's just up ahead beyond that light. Let's see these guys go up against the guardhouse. They will have some splainin' to do if they follow us in there. This guy wants to cut me off. I'll show him that's not polite.
With that, she sped up again and almost tapped the bumper of the SUV in front of him. The driver ahead sped up, and the others did too.
You got that gun handy?
As she spoke, Bernadette leaned on the horn. The SUVs around them honked too.
Yeah, I've got the gun.
Gun? What gun?
Peter shouted into the phone. Me, Peter. I've got the gun.
Jessica, you don't need it. Don't shoot. Stay with my guys. I've got to go get that bogey.
Stay with your guys? Bogey, what are you saying?
She asked. In her side mirror, about three cars back, Jessica saw a pizza delivery car cut to the right, across two lanes of traffic, and make a right turn. Not far behind was Peter's SUV. Behind him, another SUV did the same. As she strained to watch what was going on behind them, Bernadette honked again. They all reached that intersection and went barreling on through it, honking like a flock of geese. Jessica prayed not to clobber or be clobbered as they ran the light just as it changed. Peter's words finally registered in Jessica's mind.
It's okay. These are Peter's guys. We're safe. You can slow down, but not too suddenly, mind you. We must all be doing 80.
The SUV in front of them tapped the brakes. Taillights flashed, and a left turn signal started. Bernadette eased back on the pedal and tapped her brakes, too, as the entrance to Mission Hills Country Club came into view 200 yards ahead.
That's what I figured after you said, your guys.
They slowed down even more as they reached the turn into Mission Hills. The SUV on their right continued in traffic, tooting its horn as it sped off. With the two remaining SUVs, front and back, they all turned into the gates together. The driver of the SUV in front spoke to a guard, who let all three vehicles pass through right away. When they were through the gates, the SUV in front of them used the turnaround and headed back out to the road. The escort in the SUV behind them tracked them all the way back to the house. Bernadette hit the garage door opener and pulled in. By the time they shut off the engine, their escort in the SUV had vanished. The security guard who was already at the house joined them in the garage, speaking to Bernadette through the passenger window.
"Message from Peter," he said in a gruff, no-nonsense voice. "Got the bogey. Asking him questions."
Jessica's phone pinged. A text message from Peter appeared, saying the same thing.
"Thanks, Doug,"
Bernadette said, with a sweet smile on her face. Doug's gruffness evaporated.
"No problem. Heard you had a little trouble. Glad you're both okay. Stay put until Peter contacts you again, please,"
he added, returning Bernadette's smile. A smile sat no better on Doug's face than it did on Peter's.
"Am I allowed to bring you a cold drink or something?"
Bernadette asked as she hopped out of the SUV to the floor of the garage. Doug, another of Peter's men recruited from the land of giants, held the door for her. She looked up at the well-muscled black man with a buzz cut. He had to be at least twice her size, unless the adrenaline still surging through Jessica's mind and body was altering her perceptions. Bernadette was as cool as a cucumber and had already shifted from getaway driver into hostess mode.
"That would be nice. Thanks,"
he said, backing up a little.
"Doug, go give Jessica a hand getting down out of the car. The doctor says she's doing better, but she's still got some injuries. Bring her inside, will you? And I'll fix us a cold drink, okay?"
Doug shut Bernadette's door and headed around to the passenger side of the car. Jessica realized she was still holding the gun. She shoved it into her handbag before tackling what seemed to be a monumental task of moving out of the Escalade and into the house. Doug was a big help once she scooted to the edge of her seat. He lifted her out of the car and placed her on the ground. As he escorted her into the house, Jessica stewed. What a frigging stupid, scary day. How close was I to having my head blown off by a sniper or getting ripped apart by a rowdy crowd of autograph seekers? Ugh, this all has to stop, even if I have to go get that damn blue bag myself.
18. Malibu Blues. Alexis paced from one side of her bedroom to the other. Accommodations at the clinic were elegant and comfortable. The crisp, clean decor captured the spectacle of the white-tipped waves of the blue Pacific Ocean. A wall of sliders opened to a patio and a view of the ocean that pounded against the cliffs. Her lavish bath, slathered in marble, offered a steam shower and a jacuzzi tub. The bed and bath were part of a suite that included a living room with a fireplace. The patio could be accessed from the living room, too.
A small kitchen area allowed you to stash yogurt and other items for snacks. Five-star dining was steps away, though, featuring healthy haute cuisine. Other accoutrements you might expect to find at a high-end resort included a large pool, hot tubs, tennis courts, a spa, and a fitness center with an assortment of workout classes. Tall stone fences surrounding the facility were believable as structures to ensure privacy rather than to keep you inside. During the day, you could pass through gates and walk down flights of stairs to the beach below. Once you reached the beach, there was nowhere to go. The small strip of sand was bordered by rocky encroachments that made escape from the beach dicey. The setting also made it tough for paparazzi to scale those rocks, even if they could get close enough to the rocky area by boat. Alexis had already caught glimpses of several Hollywood favorites, so keeping the paparazzi out was a good thing. In principle, she could sign herself out without the escape from Alcatraz drama. Down there on that beach, though, she felt the urge to run for it. Since Hank dropped her off Wednesday night, she'd given up alcohol and her drugs. They didn't expect her to go cold turkey and had her on a regimen of medications intended to prevent severe withdrawals and make detox more tolerable. There had been rough patches in the last 2 days, but the physical symptoms on day 3 were mild. She experienced lightheadedness, antsy feelings, mild nausea, sweating, and intermittent headaches. They were at their worst when it came close to time for the clinic to administer the next dose of Suboxone. A knock at the door stopped her from pacing. Was it that time already? Alexis moved to answer the door and let the therapist into the living room. They made house calls, so to speak, in this luxurious facility by the sea, catering to the rich and famous. Perhaps the house call was also another way to take stock, observe you in a more natural setting. Like a zoo animal or a lab rat, she thought. Come on in, Angela, she said, moving away from the door. Her shrink shut the door behind her and waited for Alexis to pick a seat. When she chose a comfortable club chair with a view out to the horizon, Angela sat down opposite. She made sure not to block the view. How's it going, Alexis? How do you think it's going? I'm into day 3 without my goodies. The physical withdrawals aren't too bad, but everything is so much sharper. Is that bad? Are you kidding me? The whole point of taking Oxy or Xanax and a drink or two is to smooth out the sharp edges of the world. That was putting it mildly. How could she tell this woman how much she hated the intrusiveness of the external world? All Alexis wanted was to be oblivious to her surroundings and the truth of her situation. I think I get it, but can you tell me what you mean by that? Everything is so bright and shiny. I see edges, angles, and corners everywhere, like out there on the horizon. It should be sky blending into the sea, smooth and silky like an impressionist painting. Instead, it's this slash with flickering points of water below and a bright blue sky above. There's too much blue, and all that light bouncing off the water hurts. It's hyper-real, like HDTV, but intense and painful. Talking about it made it worse. She shifted in her seat to block the view, making eye contact with the gray-haired woman sitting across from her. Dr. Angela Graham had to be about her age. There was nothing sharp or edgy about her gray-on-gray appearance. Why doesn't she do something about that awful gray hair? And why no makeup? She's not an unattractive woman, but wrapped in a haze of gray. Who could tell? Alexis shifted back the other way to get a view of the outdoors. She blinked, as though blinded by the sun beating down on the Pacific Ocean. Is there anything that seems to help? Yeah, but you won't let me use those, she snorted, half in anger, half in laughter. Just kidding, Alexis said, as she stretched to reach a pair of sunglasses on the opposite side of the end table near where she sat. These help. She put the dark glasses on. Okay, some of what you're experiencing is withdrawals. Even with the Suboxone, that's not uncommon. I'm sure things around you were dimmer before. They had to be. You were up to 6 or more OxyContin a day, and maybe about that many Xanax, in addition to Ambien and alcohol. That's bound to blur the edges for anyone. It sounds like you feel that support has been taken from you, right? duh, was what Alexis wanted to say, but the etiquette of psycho-speak demanded better.
I've told you that's why I use them. I also know you haven't taken them away from me. That's my choice, even though I made it after getting some prodding.
By your family, you mean?
Yes, and by my doctor.
So why do you suppose you've been getting all the prodding?
I suppose because I was letting things get out of hand.
She didn't keep the sarcasm out of her voice. This talk therapy dance was painful, too. You're detoxing, and still they want you to talk and talk and talk. Individual sessions, group sessions, and lectures on drug and alcohol use. Her itinerary hadn't started bad, but it was getting more packed each day. Like joining a cult. Soon, there wouldn't be a moment left for solitude.
What does that mean?
Getting sloppy. Mixing booze with the pills. Things I should have been managing better.
So, how do you do that? Manage better?
Well, no alcohol until dinner time is one thing. Then two or three drinks, and keeping better track of when I took the last pill. Resting more. Things like that.
Resting more at night or during the day?
Both. During the day, if I get a headache or am stressed out, it helps to go to my room and rest.
Okay, so you go to your room. But isn't that where the pills are?
Yes. I don't have to take them.
Do you?
Yes, but I don't make a scene, at least.
What kind of scene?
I don't know. Breaking down or getting all needy, I guess.
Is there something wrong with breaking down or being needy? Does that bother Giovanni or your other family members?
It doesn't happen with Giovanni. I just keep moving when I'm around him. One party or activity after another. I'm like a shark that has to keep swimming or it'll drown.
She laughed as she said that.
He likes bubbly, so I give him bubbly.
Are you sure about that?
No. But does it make sense that Giovanni, or any man, would want to be around a clingy, needy drag?
And that's the alternative to nonstop bubbly. Clingy, needy, and a drag? That's the person you're afraid will make a scene. The one you hide away behind with pills and a bedroom door?
Yes, I guess so.
It must exhaust you to keep up that front. Stay bubbly all the time. What about coming up with an alternative to bubbly that's not clingy or needy, so you don't have to put on like that all the time, or escape to get a break from it? Do you think we could work on that?
Alexis was silent for a long time before answering.
Maybe, but do you think we could work on taking the edge off? Inside my head, too? My thoughts are like darts being thrown at me, a hail of pinpricks. I can't think straight half the time. Sometimes, with just the right amount of buzz, I can. Think straight, I mean. As long as that's going on, I don't think I can figure out how to be another way.
Okay. So what are the thoughts about?
Does it matter?
I don't know. Let's find out.
Okay? I'm scared to death about the cancer. I'm so tired of bubbly, and I can't always keep it up. Even when I should be able to do it. Like after my daughter Jessica's birth. I was a mom with a beautiful new baby daughter. I had money, clothes, houses, services and supports, and a man in my life that cared for me. Plus this amazing woman who started out as our housekeeper and ended up doing a lot more. Everyone told me over and over how lucky I was to have it all. Do you have any idea what that feels like? To have it all and still not be able to get out of bed in the morning?
She searched the therapist's gray, deadpan face. She didn't wait for her shrink to answer.
I'll tell you how it feels. Like you're nothing. Like you should be nothing. Want nothing. So I looked for it. A lot of nothing. Ways to push it all away.
The words spilled out, like water over a dam. Tears, too. The shrink popped up. Grabbed a box of tissues on a nearby side table and passed them to her.
Thanks, she said, dabbing at her eyes. Here I am again. At the drop of a hat, Giovanni would be on a plane from Zurich or Paris London, Rome, or wherever he is, he'd be here at my side. If I told him the truth about all that's going on, he'd insist, in fact. But I don't want him here. I don't want him to see me like this.
Like what, Alexis? You seem raw and genuine. I'd say authentic. We all need support from others. That's part of what makes us human. Why is that so bad?
It's not, I guess. My daughter's had her own problems, and I've added to them. She's standing there all banged up, having been through hell, and she's worried about me.
Yes, I saw that story. I'm sorry that you've had that shock to deal with, too. She is one fortunate young woman.
Tell me about it. She's more worried about me than she is about herself. She's angry, too, but she wants to support me. Hank, my ex, and Bernadette, too, are in my court. So I have family, people who care about me. I don't feel good about myself or safe when I break down. It's unseemly for a Baldwin woman.
That sounds like another clue, maybe, about how you view yourself and how you handle challenges, big or small, in your life. Like a new baby or a health problem. You've got a lot going for you, Alexis. It's good you can acknowledge the people in your life who care about you.
Too bad I'm not one of them, she laughed hoarsely. There was a harsh edge to the words she spoke next. I know what I've become. I'm an addict. Talk about weak and needy. I detest the booze and the pills and all the managing it takes to be a functional addict, but I'm too worn out to find a new way to live this late in life.
Well, it's hard to know how much of that is the booze and pills talking and how much of what you're describing is another problem. Is there a history of depression or anxiety in the Baldwin family?
My mother never talked about anything like that. Mom kept to herself, proud and haughty. I can tell you she did not approve of needy, so it's hard to imagine she ever felt that way, depressed or not. I'm not sure she ever felt much of anything. She was so cold and distant, so who knows?
Okay, so your mother didn't approve of needy, but it doesn't sound like you felt better when she withdrew or withheld herself from you. Does haughty, cold, and distant sound better to you than needy?
No. She didn't like bubbly either. I'm not sure how it came down to a choice between bubbly or needy, with hiding out as the solution.
Alexis looked at Angela, like she might have the answer.
What I can see is that it doesn't seem to be working all that well for you. This is a tough time. I'll grant you that. That doctor who's prodding you to get surgery says you have time to sort things out. And you're here. 62 isn't too old to learn some new tricks. Hiding out is not the way to deal with cancer. How about we take stock as you leave the drugs and alcohol out of the picture? Let's try to sort out how much of what you're thinking and feeling is the sly tricks an addict's mind learns to play, and how much is you, the real you. Then we can figure out which parts you want to hang on to, change, or discard.
That could take a while.
Sure, but it beats holing up in your room and poisoning yourself with drugs and alcohol while you get sicker from cancer.
I suppose not all the work has to be done here?
No, and you don't have to wait until all the work is done to get that surgery. That could happen soon, in fact. What you do here and in outpatient treatment will help you get through the surgery and whatever comes after surgery. In the meantime, let's talk about how we can get and keep the important people in your life where they are for now. No more hiding or dumping people before you even give them a chance to see you as you are. Agreed?
Agreed. But it might take me a few more days before I can come clean to Giovanni. It's a lot to talk about on the phone.
You don't have to do it all at once.
He knows I've had issues with pills and with alcohol, so that won't be new to him.
Who hasn't?
Maybe I'll start there. Going to rehab isn't more onerous these days than visiting a fat farm. Less, even. Rehab often gets used as a cover for nips and tucks. 28 days in rehab and you come back with a new face. I'll call Giovanni when it's a decent hour there.
She let out a long, deep breath. A breath it felt like she had been holding for months.
Good. That's a step forward.
We can process that call if you want to when we talk tomorrow. Or if you need to talk before that, find me. I don't mind, Needy, Alexis. That's why I'm here.
Thanks, Angela.
They spent another half hour together.